It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Now, I'm not saying Joe Biden's uncle was eaten by cannibals, and technically neither is Joe Biden, but he is saying this.
My uncle, Uncle Bosie Ambrose J. Finnegan, where his name was etched, he flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there used to be there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
This was too juicy a morsel of family lore for Fox News not to raise to the White House press secretary.
I agree. Second Lieutenant Ambrose J. Finnegan was a war hero. But the Pentagon says, for unknown reasons, the plane was forced to ditch in the ocean. Both engines failed at low altitude. Why is President Biden saying he was shot down? There's no evidence of that. And why is he saying that his uncle was eaten by cannibals? That is a bad way to go.
But White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre did not bite.
He lost his life. It's not, look, I'm not, we should not make jokes about
it's
this.
Not, wait, President Biden said that his uncle was eaten by cannibals.
I mean, your last line, it's for a laugh. It's for a funny statement. And he takes this very seriously. His uncle, who served and protected this country, lost his life serving. And that should matter.
But chew on this. There were cannibals in Papua New Guinea when and where Uncle Bosie's plane went down. The disease of kuru, which gave us insights into mad cow disease and the discovery of prions, was all based on the fact that the Foray people of Papua New Guinea ate each other. There is no evidence that this particular man, Uncle Bosie, was eaten by cannibals or any of the carnivorous mammals indigenous to the region. I've looked at those mammals. They're quite small, and it would have taken quite a long time to eat a mid-century Irishman. Nevertheless, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea chewed off any reporter's ear who would listen to his offense-taking. But, you know, that's the history of his country. I think maybe in this case, the prime minister just needs to eat it. About the fate of Uncle Bosie, who ate it in his single-engine plane. The guy was a hero and possibly a grinder. It depends on what term the locals use. I don't understand, although I do, why the pushback from Papua New Guinea and Papuans, New Guineans, is to deny, as culturally insensitive, the idea, the true idea, that there is and was cannibalism within the native cultures of Papua New Guinea. What's eating me is my confusion over the question, shouldn't we be trying to emphasize that the actual cultural insensitivity is to suggest that cannibalism is wrong? Isn't it our anti-autophagist view of the world at play? People who eat people are people too. Just as Papua New Guinea had a choice as to which part of the story to take umbrage over, so too does the media. The right or left get to decide what's eating at them with this story. The right plays it as a sign that Joe Biden's just a bit goofy. The left as a, can you believe what Fox News is bothering the White House about? But it is something, a little something, to handle. The White House clearly finds these questions about the president's comments, but also the substance of the president's comments to be, perhaps like Uncle Bosie himself, in poor taste. But in real news, where Uncle Bosie's demise is a bit of family lore, understandable, I would say, we should all be focusing on much, much more the question or the fact that Joe Biden helped shepherd through a massive funding measure that was stuck in Congress, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan. And Biden was not a bystander. Speaker Mike Johnson repeatedly credited Biden against Johnson's own political interest. A big deal, a huge deal, but somehow that doesn't go down easier than poor Uncle Bosie. On the show today, I shall spiel about a new UN finding about UNRWA that will open the spigots once again to funding this agency that helps the refugees in the Palestinian territories. But first, Tyler McBrien is a managing editor of Lawfare. I don't know if you know this, a certain someone is on trial in Lower Manhattan, and Tyler has been there all day, every day, except for now, when he comes on The Gist to talk about what he's been watching. Tyler McBrien, up next. We'll be right back. There's a trial going on right now. Perhaps you've heard about it. A certain former president of the United States. It's taking place in a courtroom in Lower Manhattan. And today, really, the only time this week he hasn't been in that courtroom in Lower Manhattan is Tyler McBrien. He's the managing editor of Lawfare. They do a daily podcast, by the way. But today I'm stealing Tyler for The Gist. Hi, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you. Happy to be here and happy to be loaned out for the day.
It's nice, right? It's you're being seconded, I think is what they would call it in England. So I'll start with this. Have you ever been in the same room as Donald Trump before? Looked him in the eyes? Gotten a cut of his jib?
This will be, I believe, my third time. The other two, though, were related to this trial. So the other two were during pretrial hearings, one in February and one in March. I like to think that he looked me in the eye and quaked in fear as he went down the courtroom aisle, but he could have been looking at the person next to me. Who's to say?
Yeah, someone else who maybe inspires the fear-quaking instinct. So has this trial recalibrated whatever you thought of courtroom sketch artists beforehand?
Definitely. I was recently at one of many of Bob Menendez's arraignments and got to know the sketch artists there pretty well. But I think the sketch artists in this trial have a lot to work with. They've been doing some pretty inspired work, I would say. One time they were, the tableau that one artist chose to depict was Trump with his eyes closed, which has been now a fixture. Again, we're not sure if he was sleeping, he was dozing perhaps, deep in thought, we don't know. But nonetheless, that was the pose that the artist chose to depict Trump in.
So Bob Menendez has the very intriguing prospect of having to explain away gold bars that were sewn into the lining of some of his clothes. No such pieces of evidence in the Trump trial. We're talking about the much more anodyne ledger entries. But is that the whole ball of wax? The court, the jury will be asked to consider these ledger entries and the legitimacy thereof. Am I undersimplifying it?
Yeah, I think maybe somewhat, but you're
okay,
absolutely right.
Fair.
This will be a case about documents. This was brought up several times in jury selection. One of the main questions that the prosecution asked prospective jurors is, are you comfortable with reviewing documents? They kept saying, documents don't lie. This will be a document-heavy case. Susan Hoffinger for the prosecution said it admitted this might be a slog. You know, we're going to have to look through a lot of business records. But that being said, there's a lot more at play here. There's going to be, weighing the credibility of witnesses, the tangled web of conspiracy to influence an election, and these catch and kill schemes, of which we started to hear, from the first witness, David Pecker. But you're right that the actual crimes that are charged on the indictment are the falsification of business records. And these are, ledger items.
And even that is disputed. And I wasn't aware that they were going to be disputed to the degree or in the manner that they are. So from the opening statements, can you give us an idea of what the Trump legal defense team is saying to explain what Michael Cohen and the prosecution have painted as bogus payments that were really meant to perform a catch and kill or hush money for a porn star? Stormy Daniels, Stephanie Clifford, I believe, would be the name she'd enter in court records. What does Trump and his team say about that? Does he say, no, it wasn't hush money, or does he say it was hush money for a legitimate purpose?
Yeah, that's been one of the surprising things about the opening statement. They're not denying payments to Michael Cohen. They're saying these are legitimate legal fees paid to Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, as some sort of retainer. So they're not denying the existence of the payments. They're not even denying the existence of the catch and kill schemes. They're saying that this was a normal campaign practice of information sharing with an editorial entity, and that this is just, I believe they called it at one point, campaign staff doing normal campaign stuff. So an interesting strategy of not denying the existence of, some of these things, but rather just reframing them.
Okay. And so the payments, though, from what I understand, were higher. The payments to Cohen were higher than the amounts that were paid to Stormy Daniels for her silence. How do we have any idea how they're explaining that?
That's not clear yet. I think they're explaining in a way that just the payments themselves period are the legal retainer fees to Michael Cohen. I'm not sure if then they will then explain away that Michael Cohen paid Stormy Daniels in his personal capacity with the legitimately obtained funds that he received as part of his services as a lawyer. I think that is remains to be seen.
The catch and kill part, the retaining of a journalistic entity part that you referred to, that involves David Pecker, who was then the publisher, editor of the National Enquirer.
The publisher. And Dylan Howard has also come up a few times. He was the editor-in-chief at the time.
So Pecker was the first witness. He was an interesting witness. I know Ben Wittes in the podcast loves his owlish glasses. He was not. He was a willing witness. He was subpoenaed. I have seen no evidence that he's been charged with a crime or there was any quid pro quo. He's answering the subpoena, and he's laying out essentially how the National Enquirer went about doing its business, which included sometimes that they would get evidence of wrongdoing and not publish it for strategic purposes. But my question is, why is he a better prosecution witness than defense witness?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think by way of answering your question, I think it's interesting to think of why he was first. I think Ben has also pointed this out. He is the witness with, as the prosecution would say themselves, the least, quote, baggage. He's not a porn star, which may not play well with some members of the jury. He's not someone who, like Michael Cohen, has committed perjury and pled guilty to other crimes.
Yeah, it's not just that Stephanie Clifford is a porn star, and that might not be anything to me, to you, in the eyes of the jury, but the Trump legal defense team is painting her as an opportunistic individual who is trying to shake down the Trump team, and therefore is less than credible.
Right, exactly right. So there's this extortion element. So the credibility of Clifford's and Cohen, is maybe a little dubious to jury members. Pecker, also I would admit not the most probably credible person in the eyes of some, but he almost comes across as brazen and openly sleazy, which kind of has a purity to it, I would say. Yeah. So the reason, as you said, he's not charged with any crimes, which speaks to a lot of the behavior that's coming to light here is not illegal. An affair is not illegal. A hush money payment is not illegal. These catch and kill schemes are not illegal. What is illegal was the falsification of business records to cover it up, etc. So that being said, I think David Pecker is a compelling witness because he openly is describing the details of these catch and kill schemes. He also has quite positive things to say about Trump. He says, they had a good relationship. This catch and kill scheme was mutually beneficial for the National Enquirer and the Trump campaign. I imagine there's some uneasiness among members of the jury of this unsavory element of manipulating news stories to favor a certain candidate. I can't imagine that plays well with everyone. But he's a good witness in that he's I've found him quite believable despite being the head of the National Enquirer, which is publishes Bat Boy stories and the like.
Well, does the Enquirer do that? I know that they do a lot of celebrity stuff, but I think Bat Boy might be the Weekly World News.
Right.
I think, in fact, you may have committed some sort of copyright infringement there, Tyler.
This was all in the name of satire and humor, and I'm protected.
Okay, very good. Very good. Fair use. Fair play as well. So this is what I want to get to. There are two things. I want to get to some of the detail of Trump's gag order and what we've seen from jurors, judges, lawyers. But I have to get to this as the crux of the potential guilty verdict to felony counts. It is all about the ability of the prosecution to document that there were these improper ledger entries made reflecting improper payments. Okay, that's one thing. But that's not a felony, am I right? Just that and that alone. And if that's all the DA was alleging, there wouldn't be a trial in the courtroom, would there?
That's correct. That in and of itself is a misdemeanor. The way that it's stepped up, so to speak, to a felony is if these forged records are committed with the intent to commit another crime and aid and conceal the commission thereof.
Right. Now, this is what's fascinating to me and what I didn't understand and what you're going to explain to me and my audience. I thought that, and you could get into, there are competing claims or maybe it's one of those, hey, if you want to find a claim, I'll offer you three different laws, different felonies that these misdemeanors might be tied to. It could be taxes. It could be federal election law. It could be state election law. But you have to tie it to a felony. What I thought is that would be the somewhat of the substance of the trial, that they would be, or the sides would be arguing, here's how it ties to a felony. No, that's not the case. But am I wrong about that? Is that all within the judge's discretion as he gives his instructions to the jury?
You are, I think, right about that in the broad strokes. And this is playing out immediately. So I'll give you an example. As the prosecution continued their initial examination of David Pecker on Tuesday, they started asking about Steve Bannon, who was at the time a political consultant, campaign consultant, if you will, for Donald Trump. But the defense, the prosecution was trying to paint this picture that Bannon was part of a conspiracy to manipulate National Enquirer stories to influence the election. The defense immediately objected. They said, Steve, this is hearsay, first of all. But second of all, they're trying to paint or spin some sort of conspiracy of which Bannon is a co-conspirator, but there's no conspiracy alleged in the indictment. So Joshua Steinglass, one of the DAs, stops right there. He says, there's a big misconception going on right now in the law and the case that we are not alleging a conspiracy. But as part of the second theory that they're advancing, which is the state election law theory that steps it up to a felony, setting aside the tax fraud one and the federal election theory, that itself is section 17-152, and it's a misdemeanor offense. It's also, but it, that prohibits, quote, conspiring to promote or prevent the election of any person to a public office by unlawful means. So that right there in the word is conspiracy. So we will be hearing of co-conspirators and a conspiracy of that nature.
So wait, is Trump charged with that crime?
He is not, and it is admittedly very confusing. He doesn't. When the indictment came out, everyone noted that there is another crime as part of this theory, but the prosecution, I believe, doesn't have to prove it, and they don't have to, and they didn't have to charge it. So that's the murkiness. And I'll be honest, even at Lawfare, we've been trying to parse this. My colleague Quinta Jurassic has a forthcoming article that really lays it all out really well, and so I'll encourage listeners to do that. But I think all that is to say, if we at Lawfare are struggling to figure this out, I assume a jury will as well. There are two lawyers on the jury, but even so, it's a quite a tangled web that the DA has woven.
But in closing arguments, and they'll sum up everything you in the jury saw, is the prosecution going to have to argue these payments were hush money payments, they were improper, they weren't just the normal course of electioneering? And are they going to have to argue and try to say the evidence shows and it tied to some other crime? Or will that fall to the judge? Or will the jury just have to find what the jury finds and then the judge will decide if it ties to, I guess the word is a predicate crime, or the object crime is another, I think, synonym for that they've been using in court?
Yeah, I could be wrong here, but I believe it's the former. I believe they do have to convince the jury of this. And this also came out in the jury selection process. They really pressed on the importance of the jury determining Trump's intent with all of this. So I think they'll have to also prove his intent with the falsifying the records to commit or conceal another crime, and so that's why they hammered on about discerning what he was intending to do with this falsification.
And so presumably the judge, when he instructs the jury, will say, if you found that these records were improper, if you found that Trump was paying for services that weren't reflected in what the ledgers themselves say, and you also find that the reason for that was, and then maybe he'll lay out a couple different choices. But the judge is going to say that, right? The judge is not just going to leave it to the jury to say the records were improper, and then someone else is going to do some interpretation.
Right, and that's why we've been hearing limiting instructions for, you know, several pieces of evidence. We'll be hearing it for witness testimony. I think because they have to paint this larger picture, the judge doesn't want some of this evidence to unfairly prejudice Trump, the defendant.
That's so interesting. I'm sure you read the op-ed that ran the other day in the New York Times by Jed Sugarman. And he is saying he's a professor at Boston University. And the headline reflects his thesis. I thought the Bragg case against Trump was a legal embarrassment. Now I think it's a historic mistake. Okay, let's put aside perhaps some hyperbole in the title. But his entire thesis is getting at what we were just talking about, that it's never been tried before. It's a novel legal theory to tie this misdemeanor to some sort of object or predicate crime. And Sugarman saying, oh, it's a huge mistake. So what I want to know is, it might seem that way to a lawyer. Maybe it'll seem that way to someone, or a law scholar. Maybe it'll seem that way to someone reading an essay. But to a juror, lawyer or not, they're not going to know, am I right? They're not going to know anything about the quote unquote unprecedented nature of this. They're just going to try to follow the judge's instructions. And no one's going to say to them, this has never been tried before, you're going to set legal history, are they?
No. And if the jurors are to be believed with what they said in the jury selection process, they have all pledged, or at least, you know, affirmed that they will only follow the judge's instructions. They will be fair and impartial, and they will only, you know, judge based on the facts that are presented in the case. So no, I don't imagine that, you know, they will know this is unprecedented because Trump is sitting there in front of them, but I don't think that they'll be, you know, aware of the novelty of the legal theory that the prosecution is presenting.
Yeah, I guess then you could read the Sugarman argument and say that, okay, this might play out on appeal, or maybe at trial you can say the inherent illogic of it or the logical leaps that it will require are going to be apparent and they're going to play out in the jury room. But I don't know that that's the case. I don't know that it'll seem any weirder to, if the prosecution does its job, I don't know that it'll seem any weirder to a jury than any other thing a jury is asked to decide as non-experts in the legal system, except someone taking the judge's word for what the interpretation of the law is. What do you think?
No, I mean, I think that sounds right to me. I hesitate to predict anything. The first 2 days were such a mixed bag for the defense, especially. I mean, Blanche had, I think, quite a strong performance on Monday with opening statements, only to be slapped down essentially by the judge in the contempt hearing on Tuesday morning. Of course, you know, right now his concern is the jury, not as much the judge. Yeah. But still, I do hesitate to predict that question.
And this is defense lawyer Todd Blanche, and he was, you tell me, told by the judge on day two, you're losing credibility in the eyes of this court.
That's right. And I have the transcript next to me because I want to get this this quote right. But basically, this was during the contempt hearing. That was Tuesday morning. The prosecution alleged 10 violations of violating Justice Merchan's April 1st gag order. 8 of them were Truth Social posts. 2 of them were on his campaign website. And I think Todd Blanche had a losing battle to fight, and he indeed lost it. Toward the end, I think trying to save some face, he said, and I quote, "President Trump is being very careful to comply with Your Honor's rules." I think he was trying to tie it up in a bow. And Justice Merchan essentially cut him off, quite agitated. He said, quote, "You, Mr. Blanche, you are losing all credibility. I have to tell you that right now." And he says again, "You are losing all credibility with the court." And there was an audible gasp among the press the moment he said that. I think you don't have to be a seasoned trial observer to know that that's not good. That's not something you want to hear.
Yeah. So Trump is reposting Jesse Waters and reposting or truthing statements of his own. And then Blanche, I guess trying to be a good lawyer, slips and says that Trump is being, quote, very careful. And I guess another famous New York judge already has that phrase about don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining to her. And so that would be copyright infringement. If Merchan went there, he said, you're losing all credibility. What will that mean? Is that just something that you say to a judge out of earshot of a jury to lay down the law, as it were? Or do you think that this portends other bad things to come for the defense?
It's a good question. I mean, as I said earlier, at this point in the trial, Blanche's main concern is the jury. So I think while this may have been a tactical setback, his greater strategic aims are still hopefully on track in his mind. There are procedural ways that this could hurt the defense, but you know, overall, still, I think his eyes are on the prize of a not guilty verdict or a mistrial or a hung jury, for that matter.
We've heard from one witness so far, David Packer, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, and Michael Cohen's coming up. He's going to be a big witness. Do we know when? Do they give a schedule?
No, and actually, here's one example of the tactical missteps that I was talking about. So last week, when we wrapped up jury selection, the very last thing I think that happened was that Susan Nechlis requested that the prosecution share
another Trump defense lawyer.
Right. Yes. Thanks. Would share the first three witnesses that the prosecution will introduce. And Joshua Steinglass for the prosecution, an assistant DA, said, "You know what? That's actually a courtesy that we're not inclined to extend to you and your client right now because your client has been, you know, in their words, attacking the witnesses publicly. So you know what? We're not going to do that unless the judge orders it. We're not going to do it." And Justice Merchan, knowing that this contempt hearing was coming on Tuesday, knowing that there are 10 counts, perhaps hearing attacks on his daughter, which was cause for the expanded gag order, said, "You know what? I'll side with the prosecution here." And then Todd Blanche stood up and he said, "What if we can promise the court that Trump won't post about the witnesses?" And Merchan called his bluff, essentially. He's like, "I don't think you can promise that, you know, based on your client's past behavior, not only in this trial, but also in the civil trial with Justice Engoron, who, you know, in that trial, Trump was also held in contempt of court for violating a gag order." Again, it's a different context. It's a civil trial, but that has been brought up in some of the court documents of Trump's past behavior in other trials in New York.
Yeah. Also, I would say in terms of strategy and gamesmanship, the prosecution's attitude is we'll take anyone in any order. We're prepared. We have not so much to gain from knowing the order, but we think that Trump and your side has something to gain from exactly that, intimidating certain witnesses.
Exactly. I think, as the prosecution would say, it's courtesy and we're not inclined to do it. And anyhow, you should be prepared for every witness every day.
Tyler McBrien is the managing editor of Lawfare. He's at the Trump trial. Well, this current Trump trial is reporting from it every day. And you could catch his postings, his podcasts, his writings on Lawfare and on the Lawfare feed of their podcast. Tyler, excellent. Thank you so much.
Mike, thanks for having me.
And now the spiel. Germany today announced they would resume funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for the Palestinian refugees. That's good. Germany is UNRWA's second biggest funder, and the Palestinians certainly need lots of relief. This is all on the heels of a United Nations investigation that was largely or significantly exonerative of the agency that provides assistance to millions of refugees, including being far and away the most important relief agency in Gaza. You may remember on this program, I took issue with a public radio program on the media and their treatment of the situation, which was to present the only problem as being that anyone was saying there was a problem with UNRWA. Not the case. Because even the United Nations itself gave credence to the very serious charge that some UNRWA employees actually did participate in the October 7th attacks. Here is a State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, a few months ago, explaining then why the U.S. had suspended funding of UNRWA.
"We made that determination when UNRWA came to us and said they were aware of these allegations, they had investigated them, they had found them to be credible. And again, this is with respect to the 12 UNRWA employees who were alleged to have participated in the October 7th attacks, not any of the broader allegations that have been leveled at UNRWA. UNRWA itself had done an initial investigation, had found those allegations to be credible enough that they had fired all or most of those employees. So no, I think we acted appropriately given the facts that were presented to us by UNRWA, not by Israel, but by UNRWA. And so we are welcome the conclusion of this first investigation. We'll look to see what the other one produces."
This report is the other one, and it found that there were some violations of the neutrality standards in UNRWA textbooks. For example, that UNRWA, quote, lacks the support of the intelligence services to undertake efficient and comprehensive vetting end quote, vetting of its employees. And it also found that some facilities had been used for, quote, political or military purposes, which, quote, could include the discovery of weapons, cavities, and tunnel openings, military activities, or incursions. Not great. Okay. But the overall recommendation made by a former French foreign minister who ran the review was to tighten procedures, but to keep funding UNRWA, which I expect the United States will do. Israel does not like this. Israel complains about UNRWA, but then won't work with the UN to document wrongdoings. Israel refused to participate in the review, which noted that to date, Israel has not provided evidence that UNRWA agency staff were terror group members. Israel alleges that about 10% of UNRWA are not just sympathizers, but members of Hamas. They haven't shown that documentation to anyone outside their own intelligence agencies, or maybe some within the United States. Israel is extremely suspicious of the UN overall. You could understand why, given the number of votes time and time again that castigate Israel in a way that they don't target any other country by even orders of magnitude. Israelis find the UN's behavior so unfair, so poisonous, that Israel refuses to cooperate with any of their investigations, even in cases where it should have the confidence that the UN will make findings in Israel's interest. I think of the UN investigation into the rape of Israeli women on October 7th. Israel didn't participate in that, but the findings were that there was credible evidence of rape. Now, Israel knew in the case of the UNRWA review what the UN was going to find. Of course, the UN is not going to be more concerned about bias textbooks. They found bias in textbook, but they're not going to put that over the ability to fund the most important agency that's getting relief to Palestinians. If Israel says it has knowledge of Hamas sympathizers within UNRWA, Hamas members, and some of this knowledge or information is publicly available in terms of social media posts cheering on Hamas, then Israel has a choice. They either have to overwhelm investigators with findings to really push the issue, even suspecting that UNRWA or the UN will turn a blind eye to whatever Israel provides, or they have to accept that the United Nations is, of course, going to prioritize relief to Palestinians over the 151 reported violations of the social media policy that the report did find. Yes, you could go. You could find affiliates of UNRWA, employees of UNRWA, cheering on the actions of October 7th. So what do? The United Nations says the answer is not to stop funding UNRWA. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for UNRWA to be shut down completely, saying it's been overrun by terror elements and it's not there to solve, but to perpetuate the Palestinian crisis. I understand his points, and this is risk-free thinking and phrasing to his public. But then what? Then what do you do if you shut down UNRWA? You could say, well, the UN should pivot to competing relief organizations. Like what? The World Central Kitchen, with the IDF mistakenly targeted, killing seven? Or maybe the Palestinians should just forego relief and aid, which would not bother Netanyahu terribly, would not bother many, maybe most of his voters. But of course, it wouldn't just bother. It cuts against the very purpose of the United Nations. So if you're not offering solutions or alternatives, and you're not even participating in the critiques, then of course you, if you're Israel, you're going to have to deal with and live with UNRWA. And maybe the Israelis think there's no winning in this, but they do have to realize that the rest of the world is highly motivated by demonstrable instances of suffering. Maybe they should realize, Israel should, in their own strategic self-interest, that minimizing the images of this suffering would actually help Israel's military and security policies. I get it. Israel chafes at UNRWA. UNRWA bridles at the actions of Israel. But the world, even Israel's greatest ally, the United States, cares not for every detail of wrongdoing, every documented neutrality violation. They care for the suffering of Palestinian people. UNRWA does that quite far from perfectly. And I could just hear one of my Israeli friends complaining to me that I'm going far too easy on UNRWA. But if that's the critique, so be it. I won't even tell you that UNRWA is good, but with a carnage this pronounced, you don't need goodness. What you need is some reliable means of helping the people who are hurting the most. At this point, good or not, UNRWA represents and Israel should realize this, UNRWA represents the world's best option in alleviating suffering. And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, senior producer Joel Patterson. They call themselves the Quaint Mallards. I started calling them that. Then they just kind of acquiesced. Michelle Pesca is off to the side, a little tertiary, maybe a social affiliate, has some loose documentable affiliations, alleged affiliations with the Quaint Mallards at most. To advertise on The Gist, go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Thanks for listening.